and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. Okay, so yes, this is the Last Horror Podcast, and John Waters is not a horror director by any stretch of the imagination, although he has appeared in a couple of horror films. Although I do find his appearances quite distracting normally. He was in Excision, which is a good movie in terms of quite heartbreaking, in truth. And in a Seed of Chucky as well, playing quite a light comedic character, utilising his ability to come across quite sleazy when he wants to. In the same way, I feel like Last Horror Podcast isn't necessarily just about horror, it's about exploitation a lot of the time. And also, it's mine, so I can do what the fuck I want, can't I? Anyway. What I'm going to do today is kind of just give a brief kind of overview of his career and kind of some thoughts on his films and how they sit. And the interesting idea that a director like him can't really get a gig anymore to direct, although I don't know how keen he would be to do that now after all this time. Waters was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and that's where he still lives to this day. And his family were affluent. Middle-class Roman Catholics, and he grew up in a nice part of town with a guy called Glenn Milstead, who we all know now as the more closely as the performer Divine. So at a young age, he becomes really interested in film, not just quite glamorous, quite intelligent film. Like apparently Wizard of Oz had a close impact on him. Shown, you know, costume design, dialogue, but also some of the trash that the show was driving as well. And at the age of 8 years old, he receives an 8mm camera as a toy, basically. To give you some idea, you know, they must have had a couple of quid to be able to, you know, shoot film and get developed as a present for a child. Anyway, fast forward to 1964, and an 18-year-old Waters manages to pull together a no-budget version of a short film. So that film is called Hag in a Black Leather Jacket, which, although not released commercially, obviously unsurprisingly, was toured in 2004. And that features a mixed-race wedding, with a Klansman performing the wedding, and the rest of the audience being dressed in quite trashy versions of pop culture. And it gets shown in, you know, coffee houses, etc. Anywhere that people would be okay to screen something like that. Underground venues, basically. And then Waters goes, well, I need to learn film. So he heads off to New York University and realises that he's made a bit of an error in judgement. He's interested in the nuts and bolts and the understanding of film. And they're far more theory-led. So, you know, you've got groups of people talking about Potemkin. In his own words, he says, NYU, I was there for about 5 minutes. I don't know what I was thinking about. I went in one class and they kept talking about Potemkin, and that isn't what I wanted to talk about. I'd just gone to see Olga's House of Shame. That was what I was more into. Good shout on Olga's House of Shame, by the way. That's the old George Weiss, roughy exploitation film from the 60s, if I remember rightly. So in 66, Waters gets clocked smoking weed on campus and gets kicked off the dorm. So he turns back to Baltimore, where he then creates two more short films. Now, Roman Candles is different to other food movies that Waters makes generally. It's quite influenced by Warhol, and it's three 8mm projections run simultaneously. Which I'd imagine you'd think would be quite hard to set up if you're doing it, you know, low budget. But it's set up in a way that the images are flashing and changing, and it's a 40-minute kind of surreal piece rather than anything more narrative-based. So he's got this non-linear base. The first film that Divine pops in to, and seemingly it was, both these films were filmed to keep the price down on stolen film stock as well. So you've got three collage effects of different flashing images, and it runs for a lot of nonsensical stuff. And you've got Divine as a playing hide and seek, and there's people smoking and various elements, and nods to all sorts of different punk and pop culture. And again, not released properly commercially, but shown in various venues as a underground unusual artwork. Certainly in this case, Waters again is you know, attempting to show a more artistic side to his work, to stand out as an artistic filmmaker. And then in 1968, Eat Your Makeup is again a 40 odd minute short film, filmed on 16, and has very much sides towards shock and extremeness and surprise, with Divine reenacting part of the Kennedy assassination as playing Jackie Kennedy. And then a nanny who kidnaps teenage girls and gets them to model themselves to death in front of David Lockery, who was at the time a regular of the what was Waters' production studio, Dreamland Productions. And then there's another film that isn't really mentioned very often, Dorothy the Kansas City Pothead, which is Lost, apparently, from 1968, which features Pat Moran as Dorothy. It appears to be some form of, Wizard of Oz offshoot, but as I say, it's not available for critical review. And from there, Waters kind of changes tact and manages to cobble enough money together to go to feature films. And that first feature film is Mondo Trasho in 1969. The film itself is riffs again on these fairy tale themes, which we can see in Dorothy the Kansas City Pothead. And starts really kind of emphasising this mixture of art house ideas and surrealism, and also comedy, black comedy, and the ability to shock. Mondo Trasho is not his best film. It feels very experimental still, and it starts off with chickens getting beheaded. And then you've got Mary Vivian Pierce on the bus. Then somebody gets, seduced by a foot fetishist. And she's thinking about Cinderella while he's being overly keen on her feet. And then it turns to basically following Divine around as she drives around Baltimore. And things get more and more surreal and bizarre. And, the Virgin Mary pops up. And, and then it finishes with Mary Vivian Pierce's feet being changed for monster feet. That means she can, travel around Baltimore really quickly. There's barely any dialogue in it. It's almost silent, effectively, and it is strange. I think the most interesting thing about Mondo Trasho is the nods towards some of Mondo movies. It's very deliberately fits itself within a sphere of being a shocking, you know, an exploitation film. You put Mondo in your title, it says something about what you're doing, whether that be, you know, a Russ Meyer film or something far more grim in terms of the Mondo documentaries that were coming out of Italy at the time. But the reality of the film itself is an art house movie, about one that is deliberately quite shocking and quite, you know, trying to offend people. Multiple Maniacs probably is when his next films, when it kind of starts to fit together in terms of having a narrative that works, using shock to drive the narrative forward and keep the attention of people. And it very much features again this cast of his dreamland actors with Divine, Mary Vivian Pierce, and David Lockery, and Mink Stole, Edith Massey, etc. And the story, for what it's worth, is about Divine, who runs this like a carnival called the Cavalcade of Perversion. And you can kind of get people in for free to see an obscene acts. But even though it's free, you need to, because it's so horrible and disgusting, they have to drag people in. And this appears to be shot into like a public park in the middle of Baltimore. But the real reason why they do it is so Divine can, in effect, rob people. And things escalate quite quickly. There's a murder. They're on the run. There's a rape. And a little bit of blasphemy thrown in as well, with somebody putting the rosary beads into Divine's arsehole and talking about the Stations of the Cross, which is deliberately trying to, you know, obviously trying to shock people. And it's as you, again, you can see from that John Waters' own you know, Roman Catholic background. You know, if you want to really offend somebody from that background, you know, he knew exactly the button to press. I think the reason why Muscle Maniacs is, you know, but beyond that blasphemous scene, is a scene that happens right near the end, and it's basically, again, a surrealist moment, using shock and real surprise that kind of gets points home. And that's when Divine is raped by a giant lobster monster. Which, even as I say that now, seems a strange thing. But what it does is it completely snaps the film, effectively. And you know, Divine herself, as a character, becomes completely unhinged. And it uses very shocking scenes to kind of get you to a finale point of you know, what happens next and the ending of the movie.
Yes, folks, this isn't any cheap X-rated movie or any fifth-rate porno play. This is the show you want. Lady Divine's Cavalcade of Perversions. The sleaziest show on earth. Not actors, not paid imposters, but real, actual filth. Who have been carefully screened in order to present to you the most flagrant violation of natural law known to man.
You're sick, you're repulsive!
You, my dear, are dead!
So Multiple Maniacs involves blasphemy and two rapes. Now, I watched this in the cinema, and the lobster rape is so bizarre that it completely snaps your head back. But, you know, people were laughing at the other rape as well, which is a strange thing. But I suppose, yeah, it's an odd thing. But what it does do is kind of, you know, it shows that Waters is very keen to kind of play with these, you know, quite grim, quite offensive grey areas in art. Multiple Maniacs is certainly his first film that works proper as a feature film. Although, you know, there's not a lot to go on for them, but it isn't as complete in its vision as what comes next, but does have moments. And indeed, I would argue that that lobster scene is as good and as like jarring and as upsetting and strange and surreal as anything that he achieved in his career afterwards. You could also argue that he spent a long time trying to get something as good as that to put into the rest of the end of his films. And then obviously his next film really blows up for him. And you know, what to say about Pink Flamingos. The start of what is called his Trash Trilogy. The first film he makes that really gets beyond Baltimore in terms of people viewing it. And that underground scene, which he himself was kind of, you know, at the centre of. And instead leaps into the centre of the underground scene in New York, being part of that midnight movie screening. The film becomes a cult film, A, because it's incredibly entertaining and very funny, although, again, quite offensive, but also really kind of warms to film critics because it's, you know, off the chart strange, and the LGBT community, because at its heart is this drag artist, and it's all very fabulous and wonderful, but just terrible taste, and really thrives on its its grimness. Now, people always focus about the end of that film with its most notorious moment, deliberate in so many ways to kind of capture people's attention, of Divine eating that dog shit. But the film itself is more than that. It's in between. I mean, it takes the things that work about Multiple Maniacs. It's love for being kind of grotesque, and it's strange cast of characters, and it's what the fuck shock moments basically, and adds to it more of a structure, more of a wish to kind of grab the attention of the audience and understand that, you know, that this is an ongoing narrative and it needs to work at some point. So it literally starts at one point, gets, you know, increases over time the shock value until obviously you get to the end and it's rising there. I think it's worth pointing out as well at a time when, you know, this is 1973, at a time when, you know, pre-punk, really, it feels incredibly outlandish with, you know, dyed blue hair now is not even, no one bats an eyelid. At the time, it's completely off the wall. And because Waters, up to this point, was really working black and white film, wanted his, with the exception of one of the shorts, really wanted to kind of move to a bright technicolor, but was using cheap film, 16mm film stock. His solution was to make the cast and the interiors really bright and garish. Now that's you know, you can put that on a feedback loop to his love of The Wizard of Oz and the colour in Oz. So it is, you know, it's not technical in the sense that, you know, it's done on the film. It's actually done in the camera, which makes it all look very garish and very rough and aggressive and in your face. And that again feeds back into this strange world of this looking like an underground, terrifying place. So the film, you know, Multiple Maniacs at that time, as it was being released, was, you know, getting some underground viewings around the country and getting buzz from a certain type of audience. It was bigger, obviously, within Baltimore because it was able to be shown more. And New Line pick it up and they get shot shown at the Elgin. Now, we spoke about this kind of the success of films in the Elgin back in the midnight movie section, and this very much is this part time. And what that film does is effectively make Waters famous in a way that he isn't actually famous. He's not mainstream, he's a cult director. And that plays out with the fact that Female Trouble, which is a great movie, it features a lot of Divine being Divine, is you know, does well for a movie of its type. And Female Trouble very much focuses on one of Waters' obsessions, which is, you know, real life crime. Indeed, dedicating the movie to Manson family member Charles Tex Watson. The story itself is Divine playing a character called Dawn Davenport, who goes from being a troublemaker to being a murderer and living a very deprived life before the world catches up with her. And if it has a core thesis, it's this idea that crime can be beautiful and being awful and almost inhuman can be a deliciously transgressive act. And that's something that fits in again with 1977's final film of that trilogy of movies, Desperate Living, which features a story about two women, a suburban housewife, Peggy, played by Mink Stole, and her maid, Griselda, who go on the run after a murder, and they get arrested. As much for their lesbianism as for the murder. And they get a job option, basically live in the outskirts in this shanty town of degenerates, as it would be seen. All goes prison, and they go, well, let's go with the outcast option. And then the story is basically in that place and a plan to overthrow the queen of that town called Mortville.
It's contagious. It's outrageous. It's John Waters' Desperate Living, starring Hollywood sex goddess Liz Renee.
Oh, that support feels heavenly.
Susan Lowe as androgynous Mole McHenry.
If you don't give me a sex change, I'll cut off your Peter and throw it on me myself.
And Mink Stole as hysterical outpatient Peggy Gravel.
Get out of here, you stinking piece of flesh.
Yes, they've all had a lot of desperate living.
Ah! Oh, God! Find them, feel them, fuck them, forget them. Is that your new motto? Ah! I'm a man, Muffy. A man trapped in a woman's body.
Follow the dead-end road to Mortville, USA.
Look around you. It's a village of idiots. tase her and fuck her!
Yeah. Mortville, the bad taste town.
Yes, sir. I'm really not that hungry. Are you infectious, honey?
I don't know. My saliva tastes funny.
Watch the most perverse sex acts ever brought to the screen.
Harder!
Step into a world too desperate to play by the rules.
It isn't very pretty what a town without pity can do.
Desperate Living, featuring Edith Massey, the Egg Lady, as Queen Carlotta.
Hi, stupid! Hi, ugly!
Don't miss this rabid feast of cinema decadence from the creator of Pink Flamingos, John Waters' Desperate Living. It isn't very pretty. Coming soon from Saliva Films.
Now, from there, Waters shifts gear. After effectively three films which attempt to grow into, he does three films which are not all the same, but all with the same vibe, all the same style, the same look. Similar cast members, although Divine isn't in Desperate Living because Glenn has a job in a different film, so it had to be recast. it shifts gear. Polyester in 1981 is a satire on suburban living, which I suppose you could say, to be fair, quite a lot of this stuff was beforehand, but far more, it's very much the 1950s, picket fences, and a scratch and sniff gimmick, which I think I've spoken about before, which and the film itself features an awful lot of Divine dressed as a 1950s suburban housewife, desperate all over the place for seemingly forever, while you're meant to get your card out and get your finger and rub it and then sniff the various things of poo and gas. I think one of them is not fart. I mean, there's a fart one as well, I think, but gas as in, somebody's left the gas on. It's the thing about what I'd say about Polyester is, though, if we can turn around and say that Waters creates shock until you get successful movies up to this point, Polyester basically concedes the fact that he needs to change gear, he needs to change his movies. So while it's relatively transgressive in terms of having somebody who is having a relationship between, Tab Hunter and Divine played as a straight marriage, 1950s marriage, it nonetheless is very much a kind of off-kilter comedy, and it has a theory about it, and Edith Massey's in it, of course, so there's an element of just feeling like, why? What is this? Why is this happening? But at the same time, it's a lot lighter. There's certainly nothing that would any censor would struggle with, shall we say. And then in 1988, Hairspray is there. The original version. I think it's interesting looking back on that now. I did a screening of that a couple of years ago now, and at a cinema. And what happened was, lots of kids came. And, it was a 12, I think it is, in the UK now. I think it used to be a PG, but some of the languages, It feels very much like a film that is trying to be for everybody, but can't quite realise that, probably going around calling people spazzes isn't brilliant, although I know that word means something slightly different over in the US than it does over here. But you kind of, when you do it in the UK, you'll be like, gotta warn you. And obviously there's smoking and there's drug references and there's all these kind of things which, you don't see in family films these days, but, those films do, in the 80s, reflect a different version of family life, possibly one that was a bit closer to our own in a sense. And obviously Hairspray the story of a singer who wants to go on a show and really looks at rights, human civil rights in America at that time, at the 50s. You know, is a nod to Waters' childhood, but also a nod to the fact that he could see change coming. And I think possibly, you know, in the 60s and 70s, he also felt he was part of that change. Hairspray, I think the idea is that the story is that Hairspray does really well. It doesn't do really well. It does okay. What it does is kind of say that you can probably make some money from this guy without it being, like, you know, ridiculously offensive stuff. So Waters is able to make films for a period of time over the 90s, which are, you know, slightly of a higher budget. Certainly not no budget films anymore. But the idea that Hairspray originally was some kind of massive success and that led to the Broadway musical is not true. The remake, and obviously, you know, Waters would have done very well out of this, made $200 million. And obviously the Broadway show tours all the time and it's, you know, a great, great family musical. Some fantastic songs. But the original concept of that original film was, you know, not as big, but, you know, obviously was jumped on and turned into this big Broadway thing. Anyway, going back to Waters and his career, realizing that there's money to be made in this nostalgia, he creates Cry Baby from 1990, which kind of which did have a degree of interest. So, you know, I mean, it's, again, it's 1950s Baltimore. Johnny Depp plays a, you know, a Wade crybaby walker who, it's about, you know, 1950s delinquency and how the bad lads basically get into trouble and with the, you know, and other subcultures around Baltimore, you know, the squares and stuff like that, and it's kind of almost a Romeo and Juliet kind of story about, you know, somebody who's like a delinquent getting together with somebody who's a bit of a square, and you know, and what comes from that. Crybaby didn't make that much money. I know it's a cult film now, but at the time it didn't do that well. Well, I mean, Pecker is still has an element of nostalgia, but
Pecker, she's talking.
Hi, Mary.
Full of grease. Full of grease.
Oh wow.
Grease rage. Grease rage.
Pecker.
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 His name is Pecker.
Give me a pose.
Give me some candy!
Oh, honey, no. No, that's enough chocolate.
Say sugar.
A small town boy with big time talent.
You're my Venus de Milo, you know that?
And you're crazy. You see art when there's nothing there.
Who's just looking for his big break.
Let's hear it for Larry the Luckhead. Larry's 21 years old. Currently makes his living as a burglar.
I can't figure out what this one is. I kind of like it.
You might make a real career out of this.
How much?
You're going to buy it?
Yeah, because I love your look.
And I'd love to give you a show at my New York gallery.
Now the New York art world can't get enough. Pecker.
They really are something special.
The Whitney Museum wants to schedule a peek at Pecker. To Pecker.
To Pecker.
We're all famous.
Are you homosexual?
No, I'm not.
You wouldn't understand that.
He's going from rogue.
Show me down and dirty.
To Vogue.
You know what? I don't want to be in Vogue.
Everybody wants to be in Vogue.
What about New York?
I'm going to have my own show right here in Baltimore.
Friends of the Whitney, this is Baltimore.
Welcome to Pecker's Place.
New York was never like this.
Look, he's
Fine Line Features presents Edward Furlong, Christina Ricci, Martha Plimpton, Brendan Sexton III, Ming Stoll, Patricia Hurst, Mary Kay Place, and Lily Taylor in the new film directed by John Waters.
Supermodel!
Pecker.
Mother of God.
Mixing, it's effectively like female trouble mixed with polyester of Serial Mom, starring Kathleen Turner. But again, despite his attempts, and I love Serial Mom. I think it's really funny. It's very 90s now in terms of its obsession with like tabloid culture, tabloid, murders, and this idea that, you know, respectability is more of a way to keep yourself safe from the world than just being honest and having a good life, you know. So its main comedy comes from, you know, Kathleen Turner being all upright and wonderful and just doing unspeakable acts on the side, loads of murder and stuff like that, and like harassing people on the phone for no reason. And that kind of off... I mean, Kathleen Turner's performance is really off. It's played very straight, not campy, so it can be quite like off-putting almost, like, you know, is this okay to laugh at this? But I think that kind of wrong-footedness can really work in the film's favour. It's a 1998 film, Pecker, starring Edward Furlong, which I believe, and Christina Ricci, bombed. It's about photographer, and it's about being in, like, you know, a guy, kind of, a young guy, taking pictures in a very Baltimore part of Baltimore. And becomes, and this guy who takes, you know, pictures which are out of focus and grainy and on cheap stock and on a bad camera, despite the fact that they fundamentally are not perfect shots, capture the attention of New York art critics, mainly because they are different. And that fame kind of, from what was good about him as an artist, effectively stops him being an artist. Cecil B. Demented, which is kind of a loose version of the story of the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. And indeed Hearst appears in the film, was also not successful. It features, again, a lot of his regular cast, Ming Stoll, Ricky Lake, who's been on board since Serial Mom. And there's a story about a director who kidnaps a film star because he needs her in his film. Finally, his last movie in 2004 was A Dirty Shame, which, again, did not go that well. This mixture of, you know, regular cast members such as Ming Stoll appearing and also big names like Johnny Knoxville, who was big at the time because of Jackass, and Selma Blair. And it's, again, it's a film about sexual fetishism and sex addicts, and kind of plays around with this. It's quite meta in the sense that it kind of almost knows it's a John Waters film as a joke, actually within the movie. And there's like looking for like the next big fetish, you know, like he invented teabag and now he's going to invent something else as well. But it costs too much money to make, basically. It costs 15 mil and a comedy of that sort, which got an NC-17 certificate. Was never going to make that kind of cash, and I made about 2 million back, which effectively has been what his films have been making back for like the last 10 years. So I think that's the interesting thing about Waters. I mean, he had a run. Well, I mean, look at, you know, he's one of those directors, and you can say the same thing about Argento and Carpenter, if we're going to do it down the horror route, of being, of having a run, you know, of having a run of films which did not connect with audiences in the same way the lower budget underground stuff did. Now, what I would say about Waters is that, you know, you can split his career up pretty much into three. So you've got the experimental art house stuff, which probably finishes around Multiple Maniacs. So let's put Multiple Maniacs in that group. You've got the Trash Trilogy, which very much is where a lot of people, when they think of Waters, go to in terms of thought. And then you've kind of got polyester onwards in terms of films that take the influence and the notoriety of his earlier works, but kind of try and market it to a more mass market appeal. Even if, you know, that goes awry in the sense of, say, you like A Dirty Shame, which is NC-17, or indeed, you know, but and it's difficult to put A Dirty Shame in the same bracket as, say, Polyester, or indeed Hairspray. But really, you know, these are low to medium-sized budget movies that that aim at being mass market successes, and unfortunately don't quite achieve that. But the difference is that, you know, you compare a car, you know that 90s Carpenter, some of that stuff's awful, but a lot of I think most of Waters' work at least works as you know, in its own circles, its own sphere, its own attempts at what it's trying to do. You know, I mean, I don't think there's a perfect Waters movie. I don't think there's, you know, if you need to watch one, just watch this. They all have great positives and some takeaways. You know, Pink Flamingos, it is, you know, almost eye-watering in terms of his attempts to shock. Female Trouble feels a little long, and there were versions that were longer. Hairspray's fun, but, you know, not really anything particularly spectacular apart from it. It's very, very well written. And some of the later stuff, it's really entertaining Saturday night movie stuff, really. But I think the interesting thing is that Waters kind of sits through a lot of different counterculture, and A Dirty Shame kind of alludes to almost an internet age of wrong-footed culture. And I think that's quite interesting in itself, you know. I mean, even when he's nostalgic, it's kind of on the sidelines. And outsiders in his films don't necessarily have to be quite so extreme as they are in Desperate Living. But nonetheless, they're still a little step away from the norms of society. Waters these days does a mixture of art and writing, and does a stage show called This Filthy World, which he's done for a long time now. It's I remember seeing that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I think I'd seen a recorded version of it way before then. As well as, like, you know, versions of his work, his film work, he does some installation pieces as well, which kind of are, you know, points to his mischievous attitude. Rush is like a big bottle of poppers that being knocked over, and Hardy Hart is literally draws a line on the floor, and anyone who dares step over it is sprayed with water from a giant flower. A book collector and also writer, he wrote the book Carsick, which talks about his own a hitchhiking journey that he carried out between Baltimore and San Francisco in 2012, and appears in a variety of film roles now as well, and also appears on film and TV, basically. So, you know, everything from those horror films I mentioned earlier to, you know, random, you know, he's in an Alvin and the Chipmunks movie as a you know, and I think that more is people, you know, directors, writers, kind of nodding towards his influence on them. And I think to finish off, we should probably say why do we think John Waters has that influence? Well, I think one of the things is that he's created his own world. I always remember, like, George A. Romero saying that Tales of Hoffman got him into the concept of creating movies, because he could physically see how they did it on screen. Oh, I understand this, I can understand, they all fit together in my mind. The magic isn't necessarily there. The magic is, you know, the layout and the illusion that's in front of me and I can grasp that. And I think with John Waters, that's a similar kind of thing. You can see what he's done and how they've done it and why they've done it. It's transgression, it's rebellion, it's punk rock ethos. It's entirely based on getting together and doing something and deliberately and pointedly trying to shock. Certainly in that stuff up to, you know, Desperate Living. And I think that kind of idea of an outsider culture in that first 15 years of his film career carry through. And I think that's kind of why it feels so much fun. So even when it's got that sheen of a 90s Hollywood movie, it still feels off kilter and dangerous. And I think that's probably why he's almost beloved now. You know, he appears on a lot, he gets invited into lots of TV, and you know, he's got his regular anecdote he can pull out any anecdote off a hat. But I think that's probably why he always offers great quality, but it's more than just that.
Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you that smoke anyway, it gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Right, thanks very much for that. Next week, I think, if I've got the time, I'm going to try and do something in praise of our current UK Tory overlord clusterfuck that we will be living through until whenever it finally combusts, which could be anything from this week to 5 years. I'm going to do something about horror censorship, which, as I know, you know, I've done the Physio Nasties, but I'm going to do it a bit broader than that. So let's talk about the hate rating a bit more and kind of weave it through. I think for me, probably make it quite personal in terms of my own feelings and opinions on a lot of this stuff, mainly because I'm probably, you know, with the Nasties podcast, I did a lot about a very particular period of censorship history. But, you know, let's broaden that out and discuss. And I think, you know, really get down into why these things get banned, and also what are the reasons why. I mean, listen, that Pink Flamingos we were talking about, that's still cut by about 4 minutes in the UK. So Desperate Living never got, would now be passed on cut, but no one submitted it. It's got an eye gouge cut out. So it's always very strange when you see that kind of stuff. So, you know,